Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I'm always privileged to be able to present to you all individuals that I've had the privilege of getting to know and work with and admire greatly, especially for the work that they have rendered to our country, in many cases over a lifetime of experience. In doing just what we try to do with each of these programs, namely protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic. In fact, many of them have taken an oath of office to do just that, and that is true of our guest for this very special edition of Securing America. His name is Colonel Derek Harvey, United States Army retired. He has served in a number of capacities over both a distinguished military career and in civilian life. Among the military posts, he was the senior intelligence and policy advisor to successive commanders of our military operations in Iraq. After he left the military, he became a senior professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. Let me say that again. After he left military service, he became a senior professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee, working closely with its chairman and then ranking member, Congressman Devin Nunes. Derek Harvey is these days a county commissioner in the great state of Maryland, and we are delighted to have him with us to talk about, well, a host of challenging topics, foreign and domestic, involving protecting the country we love. Colonel, it's great to have you with us. Welcome to Securing America.
It's great to be here. I really appreciate having the opportunity to speak to you and your audience.
Well, the opportunity is one that I'm hoping you will take advantage of frequently in the days to come. But thank you for giving us an hour of your time today. I want to start with a topic that I know in the course of your military career, as well as your civilian role in the HPSI, as it's known, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, was very much top of mind, and that is the coming threat of, well, possibly kinetic war, but certainly of decisive, unrestricted warfare against our country at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. How would you characterize the threat we face from the CCP, as it's known, at this moment?
Well, for sure, Frank, it's a complex and, I would say, a hybrid non-kinetic effort right now, employing information warfare, economic warfare, influence operations, in particular, directed at leaders in our economy, our business community, and state and local officials, not just in DC. And we can discuss how that manifests itself in some detail going forward with some particular examples like Sequoia Capital or Wall Street, and how people inside of government, as well as leaders on the outside, leverage their advantaged position through investments in the cajoling and influence of the Chinese Communist Party to enrich them, but also demand from them an effort to influence U.S. policy, as well as siphoning or directing American investments into China, which is critical to financing their development of advanced technologies, be it artificial intelligence, autonomous drones, new propulsions for ballistic and space launch missiles, across the board, hypersonics. And we, the American people, through our institutional investors like CalPERS or Massachusetts Fund, are advancing these interests and directly improving the military capabilities of China to eventually fight us, whether it's in Taiwan, Indochina Sea, or someplace else.
You've set a very rich table, and we will try to sample each of the dishes you've served up. But let's just stay with the sort of 30,000-foot level for a moment, Colonel. When you think about the Chinese Communist Party, One of the things that I know is very much, you know, part of your analysis, but not obvious as it should be to many Americans. I like to think not our audience, but many others. And that is the actual ambitions of Xi Jinping, the newly coronated emperor, if you will, of China, and the Chinese Communist Party under him. How would you characterize those ambitions?
Well, I would like to address that point real quick and then shift to why we failed to fully appreciate the nature, character, and scope of the emerging Chinese threat over the last 20 years. And I think that's very important because, you know, the politicalization or influence of our intelligence community had a great deal of influence over that. And as, you know, the Director of Investigations and Chief of Analysis for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, I know a great deal about that. And I also know how the National Intelligence Estimate process and the National Intelligence Council work and how they've been influenced. And just changing assumptions or the parameters of a question for the White House can heavily influence the outcome of the analytics. So now to your question, I think there are a number of people like Michael Pillsbury and others who have addressed the issue of the nature of the Chinese regime, the Chinese Communist Party. But, you know, it is in fact a very nationalist, historically based, culturally aligned effort by the Chinese Communist Party, building and strengthening nationalism. And instead of thinking about it in terms of a communist country or something else, it's a one-party authoritarian state that is aligned with almost capitalist principles in building large corporate capabilities across multiple spectrums of their economy, okay, almost every sector. And this state and I would say big tech, big industry alliance, okay, is more like Nazi Germany than a Marxist state, okay? And I think we sometimes fail in appreciating that effort. And their driving ambition is rightful leadership in the world that is owed to the superior Chinese Han dynasty, if you will. And that's how it's communicated internally. And the promoters of that, the representatives of that are the one-party communist organization there with President Xi at its head. And their ambition is to supersede the United States and to impose on the world through carrots and sticks its vision of this one-party, technocratic, integrated, big government, just big government, aligned with big corporations, squashing individualism and freedoms and liberties in the name of the Chinese way. And they see it as a Chinese way for the future. So they are building across the world, okay, to penetrate markets, trade routes, etc.
Okay, this is really helpful. And I noted you said in the introduction that, you know, all of this kind of depends on the assumptions to get certain analytical outcomes. What you've said is not based on assumption. What you've described is what we know to be true of the Chinese leadership, its policies, and its ambitions. And we have to take a short break. We're going to come right back and talk about how that is being translated. I think you're absolutely right. It's fascistic into mortal peril for us. More with Colonel Derek Harvey on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Former Vice President Mike Pence is the latest politician found to have classified documents in his home, fueling a renewed effort to downplay the significance of Joe Biden's mishandling of such materials. What contradicts the spinning is fresh, if circumstantial, evidence that the president's son Hunter shared a secret State Department paper to get hired by a Ukrainian oligarch. New York Post columnist Miranda Devine discovered on Hunter's notorious laptop an email he sent his prospective employer. It contained an apparent official analysis of U.S. policy options for possible sanctions against Ukraine. Congressional investigators will need to explore whether Joe Biden not only illegally retained and stored such a classified document, but shared it with his son to advance their family's pay-to-play influence operations. And even more concerning was other highly sensitive information shared with Hunter's friends in Chinese intelligence. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are speaking with United States Army retired Colonel Derek Harvey, a man of considerable expertise, both in uniform and in civilian life, in the national security arena, specialties being intelligence and national security broadly defined. We're talking with him now about the threat of our time, the existential threat, my old boss Ronald Reagan would say, of Communist China, and specifically how the ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party, as you've said, Colonel, to supersede the United States poses really an existential threat to us. One of the things I want to come to shortly is the help that the Chinese are getting in trying to accomplish that from Americans. But before we go there, just a further word about this unrestricted warfare that the Chinese communists have been waging against us, again, mostly unbeknownst to the vast majority of Americans, I think it's fair to say. Talk a little bit about that and how it is they've gotten away with it without more of us recognizing the danger that it poses.
Well, I think we have to focus on understanding who the enemy is or who they think they are. And, you know, having worked in the intelligence community for over three decades, and, you know, I've taken contrarian views time and again with the national intelligence leadership about the future of the North Korean nuclear ambitions. The national intelligence community was wrong in the early and mid-90s. The alternative analysis that we wrote turned out to be correct. In Iraq, on NIE, National Intelligence Estimate after National Intelligence Estimate, going in, during, and near the end, we wrote alternative assessments challenging the consensus documents that, or consensus analysis that was force-fed primarily by the Central Intelligence Agency to a conclusion that was more palatable in Washington, D.C., that missed the real reads. And the same thing in Afghanistan, and the same thing with China, by the way, over almost three decades. So, you know, Bob Woodward and others have written about my approach and how I came to these different conclusions. And even DIA, who I worked for at the time, and Army Intelligence sent me to the White House to brief President George Bush and the Security Council, and they distanced themselves from the analysis that I was going to present, that we were facing an industrial strength insurgency based upon the remnants of an old regime motivated by branding itself in Islamic nationalist terms and rejecting the Ba'athist past, even though they were still Ba'athist, and how they were going to sow division, create violence and chaos in order to undermine the birthing of the new Iraq that, you know, President Bush and Dick Cheney, and how they were going to do it, what their motivations were, tactically, operationally, and strategically, was decipherable by reading what they said, debriefing them, and paying attention to what they said during debriefings, capturing documents, going through cell phones, communications, text messages, and spending hundreds of hours talking to them in detention centers, which is what I did. Now,
but Derek, if I could just say, it sounds from what you've just described as though this is a fact-based, open-minded approach to an intelligence assessment. And I personally am absolutely convinced of the necessity of competitive analysis. You know, we've done a couple of Team B exercises, yes, which are all about that. And I salute you for standing up to the consensus and the lowest common denominator that obviously all too often comes out in each of these cases. And just on to come back to China for a moment, to the extent that the consensus has been, if we only help the Chinese become richer, they'll become more like us, and there's really no need to worry about a threat. Is that an apt characterization, basically, of what you were bumping up against?
Frank, that was a desire by going to Bush through Obama, and it changed fundamentally in the first year of the Trump administration on the policy side in the NSC and in the White House. Unfortunately, not in DOD, not in state, and not for sure in the intelligence community. So if you read their documents going back to the late 1990s about what their aspirations were, about what they wanted to do militarily, about how they wanted to penetrate regions of the world economically, and then eventually to expand and have a military ability to have bases around the world to project power from. That was all clearly articulated, but ignored. We assumed these challenges away. So that led us...
Before we go on, that's such a key point. Why were they assumed away? Is it again, a question of the politicization by the wishful thinking policy types of these national security agencies, or is there something else going on there?
Well, it is complex, but I would say there's a bureaucratic element to it. There's a personal character element to it of people that are unwilling to stand up. They know what the message is and that is desired. And when the White House frames their desire for an NIE, a National Intelligence Estimate, and they put boundaries on it and they say, we don't want you to consider these things or these things. Here are your assumptions that you're going to work with. And
it's the old garbage in, garbage out line.
I think, isn't it? Now, to the credit of organizations that aren't part of the DC Beltway experience, JICPAC and the Pacific Command, over that whole time period, they correctly foresaw the growth and desire for a blue water navy with aircraft carriers, et cetera.
On the part of the Chinese, you're talking about.
Right. They correctly foresaw the development of a triad of ballistic, air, and sea-delivered nuclear capabilities. And, you know, when you saw all these capabilities being developed that are meant to be able to deliver nuclear weapons, air, sea, and ground-based, you should ask yourself, all these delivery platforms at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, how many warheads do they have? And if you stay on the same number of warheads that they had in 1982, and you don't update those number of warheads for 30 plus years, you're in trouble because you have blinders on. And here's the key thing. The alternative analysis, or actually the accurate analysis, was so inconvenient to the agendas of the policymakers, both Republican establishment and Democrat establishment, because it got in the way of the deindustrialization of America and the economic wealth of the elites, of what we call the uniparty elite of both parties. And China understood how to manipulate our system against us.
And this is really the point to which I want to turn next. We have to take a break here in just a moment, but you've put your finger on the enabling of the unrestricted warfare the Chinese communists have engaged in for decades now. And the blinders that we've had on, notably, but not exclusively, in the intelligence community, in seeing what they're actually not just saying, but doing, and making correct, realistic, clear-eyed conclusions derived therefrom. And all of that has been greatly facilitated, I think it's fair to say, by the elite capture that the Chinese have made a centerpiece of their, well, strategy for taking down and displacing the United States of America. We'll talk about more of what that looks like and what it means, well, among other things, for you, with Colonel Derek Harvey, right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're continuing this hour-long, very, very special, very important, very timely conversation with a man who knows his way around the national security beat big time, having lived and worked in, well, the key institutions of our national security for decades, both in the uniform of the United States Army, through which he rose through the ranks to that of colonel, and in the civilian side as well, notably as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. Derek Harvey, when you look at this practice of elite capture, when you look particularly at some of the elites that the Chinese have invested heavily in, I don't know, compromising, suborning, recruiting, enriching, to be sure, sort of at the top is one that you referred to, I think, at the very beginning of our conversation, namely the financial sector. And I just would ask you, I know you were doing a study on the House Intelligence Committee before you and Congressman Devin Nunes left, of this outfit called Sequoia Capital. It's just one example of this penetration of a key sector of our economy. Tell us what you learned about Sequoia Capital, who it worked with, what it did with its contributions, among other things, and how it really exemplifies this very, very insidious subversion of our financial sector by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, I think it's an important thing to discuss because Sequoia epitomizes it. And I didn't know anything about Sequoia, but Chairman Nunes asked me as his chief investigator, and we've been dealing with Russia hoax and FBI corruption and other issues, of course, but he's always considered China to be the number one threat to the United States. So we decided after the 2020 election to really focus hard on Chinese influence operations across the board in the United States. And he asked me to organize an effort to take a look in an on-class way what China was doing. And part of the reason for that is we understood, and you know, the DNI was very clear about this, that U.S. firms have been
Director of National Intelligence, right, of course. Mm-hmm.
Sharing key technologies and helping China acquire key technologies and sensitive intellectual property. And that the companies in the United States and Wall Street leaders, et cetera, were taking guidance from the Chinese government and Chinese Communist Party emissaries. And that these Chinese Communist Party emissaries serve on U.S. company boards and act as senior company executives, as global stewards. Companies that they own outright, for example, like AMC and Smithfield Foods, but also their influence on decisions in the NBA and with venture capitalists, the U.S. largest venture capitalist firm, Sequoia Capital. And they encourage these companies to shape the perception of America and to open up doors in America for their investment and for them to acquire things like farmland, technology, and get access to reading rooms for startup companies to understand where our technology is headed early on. In other words, as the DNI said, to help present China to the world. So Sequoia Capital, based in California, the former chairman, president, was a guy by the name of Mike Moritz. We looked at that company and we became very concerned when we saw a gentleman by the name of Neil Shen, that's the name he goes by in America, who is a Politburo advisor and coordinator for Chinese economic initiatives in AI, bioscience, technology of all types, from autonomous vehicles to other things. And how they did this is Neil Shen was the global steward for Sequoia Capital. So that became their platform in the United States. And then there was a Sequoia Capital China that Neil Shen is the president of. And they work hand in hand. And with the help of the Chinese Communist Party, and just know that there is no such thing as a private entity in China. They all work for the Chinese Communist Party. So we have to shed that perception that there's anything private over there. They all work for the same boss. Shen and the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, are the gatekeepers for investments and profit for American Wall Street or firms that want to get into the business of investing in electric batteries, biosciences, genetic engineering, DNA manipulation across the board. And your profit is dictated and guaranteed by the Chinese Communist Party, and that profit comes back. We have institutional investors. Well, that's the key thing. They all do, and these entities that are investing and sharing technology and R&D in order to get into the Chinese market where they're guaranteed a return on their investment. So the University of Penn, Harvard, Cal, these are all universities that are doing the same thing. And many of them, like Crankshank, which is, you know, a $4 billion entity of a Sequoia Capital executive, they then invest in political donations. So Crankshank and Mr. Moritz provide and coordinate raising $300 million last year for the ACLU. And the ACLU then pursues civil suits and court cases to stop the United States government from banning TikTok or lessening the influence or opening up doors for Chinese technology initiatives, or basically providing protection for them legally by harassing DOD or Commerce or the SEC.
Lawfare, in short.
It is. And when they do get caught with illicit financial activities in Wall Street and they lose in civil cases, the SEC will fine them $30 million, $45 million, but they walk away with $2 billion in profits. And the losers are American consumers and investors.
And the key piece of that, let me just ask you, the part that is so infuriating about all of this, and the, by some estimates, $3 to $6 trillion that has flowed, not just of course from Sequoia, but BlackRock and Vanguard and Fidelity and State Street and so on. But that's not their money. That's the money of American investors, pension plans and 401k plans, and mutual funds.
And that's money not invested in starting American companies.
Bang.
It's not, and so we can't find, I was in Dallas at a venture capital initiative. I was in Atlanta. And the challenge for a lot of American companies is getting capital, borrowing the money at a decent rate. And we're pouring money into China, and we're not financing our own initiatives.
And at the same time, we're actually having people like BlackRock that are helping that migration of funds, penalizing, disrupting, and even, I would argue, destroying the American economy with their whole ESG agenda.
Here's where it gets complex. So this money comes back in, and it benefits Kerry. Former Senator Kerry, now our climate czar. He's got investments in favored energy programs in China that are guaranteed for him. The money comes back as donations from these companies, these elites, into the Democrat Party. And then you get people, National Security Division and the Justice Department, or Securities Exchange. And we see the same names, like people might recognize Lisa Monaco, or Nancy Pelosi's chief attorney that's now handling these Chinese initiatives, or Biden's folk. These are familiar people that we've been investigating. If you follow the news closely, they are key people in the DOJ and FBI that have been involved in a number of issues that have been very questionable and downright wrong from our view. We actually made referrals from the House Intelligence Committee, criminal referrals, about a whole range of issues, and they've been squashed. It's the same people that have been doing these partisan things that are involved in the China initiative today that were involved in the Russia hijinks back in 2016 and 17. So that's a major problem that we have. At the end of the day, the problem is the money flows in and it influences the decisions of our government. So we have NSC and White House officials going to the SEC today to influence SEC decisions about Chinese access or punishments. And this is corrupt as can be.
It is. So you've described our money flowing with the manipulation of compromised Wall Street firms and individuals. It's coming back in the form of investments, in some cases, by Chinese companies, and in the form of contributions from those American companies that they've invested in, I guess principally because the Chinese aren't supposed to be investing in our politicians directly. But the money is clearly tied to being soft, shall we say, on China, is it not? And I just want to ask you, and we're going to take a very short break here, but when we come back, I want to get at the question of, are the Republicans, as well as Democrats, who have been compromised in this process? We'll be covering that and much more with Colonel Derek Harvey, longtime national security professional, great friend of this program. Beck, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. If you have been following the program to this point, our guest, Colonel Derek Harvey, United States Army retired, has laid out a very, very troubling picture of how not only we face the greatest existential threat to freedom in the form of the Chinese Communist Party, but how it has been enabled and abetted by American entities and individuals over the years to become even more formidable, even more dangerous. And Derek, you kind of set up in the last block the problem that is rife, clearly, of Democratic politicians benefiting from Neil Shen and others' campaign contributions and the like. Are there Republicans who have also been subject to this kind of, contribution, elite capture, call it what you will?
Yes. And, you know, some of it is probably knowingly, and much of it is probably unwittingly. Okay. But I'll just remind you, and I think I mentioned this to you, Frank, that, you know, we began this investigation and we sent inquiries to over 40 companies. And the only company not to respond to our inquiries was Sequoia Capital. And we had many specific questions. And at the end of the day, you know, we didn't get those answers. But a matter of weeks after they received our notification and our inquiries, they began to make donations to Kevin McCarthy's Victory Fund at the end of 2021 in the fall. And
let me just ask you to pause. The investigation was not being conducted by the House Intelligence Committee. It was being conducted, as I understand it, by the minority on the committee. Is that right?
Right. It was an independent activity of ranking.
So that would prompt Sequoia to be very interested suddenly in the Republicans.
Correct. It was a letter from signed by Ranking Member Nunes and the other Republicans on the committee. And we continued to pursue issues that, you know, Congressman Nunes thought were really important, whether or not, because the Democrat leadership and Adam Schiff had absolutely no interest in pursuing these things, none. And so we did pursue it. And shortly after the letter was received, donations to the Victory Fund from Sequoia Capital principals and family members began. And
Kevin McCarthy's leadership pack.
Right. Right. And at the end of the year, Devin resigns. Mr. Mike Turner, congressman from Ohio, the Dayton area, takes over. And one of his very first things within the first 2 weeks is to dismiss the people that were leading the Chinese initiatives, the investigators, staff, and lawyers, to bring on people that have no experience in intelligence or in investigations. And it did absolutely shut down this Chinese investigation.
The reason this is so important, as you clearly understand, is that I don't think this is an exaggeration, Colonel. If this country is to be saved from the peril that the Chinese Communist represents, it's going to start with rigorous investigation of what the Chinese are up to, the various ways in which they're waging this unrestricted warfare against us, by all of the relevant committees in the House of Representatives within their respective areas of jurisdiction, of course. And the thing that's so chilling about what you just said, and which I must say I've been worrying about for some time, and actually was one of the considerations I had in opposing Kevin McCarthy's candidacy as the next Speaker of the House, was will he allow those investigations to actually get the ground truth about what is being done within the financial sector specifically? Not just by Sequoia Capital, obviously.
Absolutely,
but
right.
Others as well.
You've got numerous billionaires that play all sides and corporations that benefit from access and are critically dependent upon China now in many ways. I mean, we get 85% of our important prescription drugs from China. So we're very dependent. We've made ourselves dependent, you know, purposefully. But I don't know if Mr. McCarthy understood where the money was coming from or why, or if it was tainted. I really don't. I don't know if the right questions were asked, because politicians need and desire money. But when you take money, there's an element of influence that comes with that. And I think we all know that.
But I have to say, it just strains credulity that if he knew it was coming from Sequoia, and the upshot, it would seem, maybe it's not cause and effect, but certainly it's sequential, that the investigation, that independent investigation, gets shut down, it just smacks of a certain amount of knowledge of what was going on.
Knowing Mr. Turner the way I do, but he was selected because he's malleable and he doesn't have much of an appetite for real investigations. He's a Eurocentric congressman who's enamored with going to Munich security conferences and wants to be understood and appreciated by the media and others. Okay, so that's the character we're dealing with there. He has no interest in China or these other issues. So, you know, there could be...
But that's of concern. He should not be in that job. Yeah, absolutely not. We're going to have to take another break. And when we do, I want to pivot to another topic. But just to close this all up, Derek Harvey, based on your personal professional judgment as a lifelong national security practitioner, is it the case that this elite capture phenomenon is putting our country at even greater risk than were we simply being faced with all these other vectors of attack by the Chinese Communist Party?
Absolutely correct. It puts the economic security and the welfare of the American worker at risk. And it puts our national security at risk militarily and in ways of medical threats and the like.
So much more. All that supply chain dependency is
a
disaster waiting to happen. And it's not going to wait much longer, I fear. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to turn to a subject very close to home, the battlefield of Antietam. One of the greatest battles of all time is, I think, being defiled. We're going to talk with Colonel Harvey about that right after this. Welcome back. And a heartfelt thanks to our guest, Colonel Derek Harvey, for giving us a full hour of his time. The conversation that we've just had is one of the most important, certainly in my professional life and certainly in the history of this program. But I do want to close with something that is top of mind for the Colonel in his role today as a newly elected county commissioner in Washington County in the state of Maryland. A very important part of which is the historic battlefield of Antietam. And Colonel, I want you just to help us understand the importance of that battlefield, what went on there. Talk about hallowed ground. And the battle that's underway at the moment, and who the combatants in it are.
Well, Antietam Battlefield was the bloodiest Civil War battle during that 4+ years of the North versus the South. And it's just north of the Potomac River in western Maryland, near the narrowest point, you know, about 20 miles of depth between the Pennsylvania border and the West Virginia border. And the tremendous battle, and the South took a heavy loss there. And Robert E. Lee was beaten back into West Virginia and the South. The problem is that we have a park superintendent here who unilaterally, her name is Susan Trail, Antietam Battlefield Park Superintendent, decided that we will no longer be allowed to have a national level 4th of July celebration with the Maryland Symphony Orchestra and tens of thousands of people that come to Antietam Battlefield for the day. They visit it, there's commemorations, and then there's the fireworks at night, the largest in Western Maryland, with this great orchestra. And tens of thousands of people are sitting all over the battlefield observing the fireworks and listening to patriotic songs. And it's very respectful, and it's well cleaned. It's cleaned up afterwards. It's a beautiful event, and it's the biggest event we have in Western Maryland. She's decided, without any reason, to say we can't do it anymore. And not only that, but she's denied our commemoration with illumination candles along the trails at the anniversary of the battlefield in September each year now, with no reason whatsoever given. And from what we understand, it's an attempt to diminish the importance of the 4th of July and the founding and all of the relevant celebration about our history and the importance of our founding fathers, the documents and stuff that everyone celebrates here in Western Maryland.
Yeah.
That's,
you know,
part of one.
This is so stunning in part because it is such hallowed ground, and this commemoration of the battlefield. And I understand this gal is also on the pretext that COVID would make it unhealthy.
Well, we shut it down.
The reenactments right. of the battlefield, what took place on that battlefield, has also been suspended. Is there no adult supervision? This sounds like a kind of Marxist effort to either rewrite or at least disparage and ignore our history. Is that what's going on, do you think?
Well, Miss Kim Hall is the park superintendent's boss, and we cannot get any answers from any of them. And we've reached out to Senator Ben Cardin's office and gotten no support. Congressman David Trone, our representative here who does not live within the district, with no support, both Democrats. And then Senator Chris Van Hollen's office, and again, no support. And this is a Democratic administration. And I just think of Mount Rushmore and other places in the country where the Park Service is denying 4th of July celebrations. And I also heard from social activists in this area that it's part of an attempt to diminish the 4th of July, as they are desiring to increase the importance of June 19th.
Juneteenth, as it's known, which
right.
is a day that now is a national holiday that recognizes, you know, a black celebration of...
celebrate both and honor
Absolutely.
Them both.
I can't imagine that both would not be honored, especially now that Juneteenth is a national holiday. But just if you could, and we've got just 2 minutes left, as a man who has devoted his lifetime to service of our country, who has fought in the uniform of the United States Army, and who has since you took it off after you retired, continued to serve our country in a variety of really important capacities. This must make you sick. It certainly does me. When I think about what's being done to in effect, deny new generations of Americans a sense of the kind of patriotic fervor that I know you feel, Derek Harvey, and that we all should feel in this extraordinary country of ours. Just take us out with a little sense of what this means to you and why it has to be fought.
Well, it's really important to me because I have three young children. We have extended family here, and this is part of our American history, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and we need to understand and learn from all of that. But this is a patriotic event, and it comprises all the best about America, you know, on this day where we should all be coming together to celebrate. And it's being denied without any reason given whatsoever. So that's extremely disappointing. It's also economically impactful in a negative way because we're not doing it. It's the biggest event of the year out here in Western Maryland. Brings in a lot of tourist dollars, hotels, meals, buying souvenirs, etc. And it brings the community together, you know, of all the demographic categories. It's a unifying event. And that's what's disappointing to me. We're going to miss that terribly.
Well, we mustn't let that happen. I say, let's see what we can do to get this decision reversed. Derek Harvey, we look forward to working with you on that score and in all the other respects that we've discussed today. Thank you for that great service of your country, and Godspeed in continuing it in your new role as the Washington County Commissioner. Thanks to all of you for being part of this really extraordinarily important program. I hope you found it edifying and that you too will go forth and multiply.